on radio, streaming live on investtalk.com, and for our podcast subscribers. This is InvestTalk, above average investing for the average investor. InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. And now, KPP Financial Executive Vice President, Financial Advisor Justin Klein.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to InvestTalk. This is our Monday, June 29th, very eventful edition of InvestTalk, and we welcome you to this roundtable about managing your money, and we re-entertain any money questions and any topics that might come to mind that you might want to get another opinion on, some insight about, some information on. So give us a call. We know the decisions you make financially can be very tough, so we hope to give you some insight on this hour and try to help you make those decisions that you have to make with confidence. And as you know, we stress learning here on InvestTalk, and we try to make it easy to get your hands on books that can help you at any level of experience. So please visit our recommended book section on InvestTalk.com. Now, here are a couple books that can give you some perspective on the market. One called Bull. It's a history of the boom and bust, 1982-2004. And in 1982, the Dow hovered below 1,000, and then the market had a very large rise, and now we're where are we at now? I think we're down in the year, but I think we're still at, let's see, almost 1,750 or so. So it talks about the boom and bust of that era, and it's good to get some perspective on history. It's very important. It's extremely important. I think that's the number one lesson everybody should be learning, is not just the last 10 years or 20 years or 30 years of the market, because in the grand scheme of things, that's a relatively short period of time. And that period of time is very different than the 30 years before 1982, when we had the start of the secular bull market, right? There was a secular bear market before then, a secular bull market before that, and a secular bear market before that, and it goes that way back and forth. If you don't know what I'm talking about, secular bull and bear market, you should know. You need to read up, listen up, figure out what that means, because it's extremely important for you to have that knowledge so you can have the proper perspective when you are making your investment decisions. So there's a lot of great books on the site, and there's another book that will expand your view of the nature of our economy and the market, and it points out that change is what we can expect, and we need to embrace that change. It's called Creative Destruction, Why Companies That Are Built to Last Underperform the Market and How to Successfully Transform Them. Now, you've heard Steve and I mention it over the years, and it's a concept that everybody should get a grasp on, because every company at some point or another will go out of business, right? Every company that was started 2,000 years ago is not in business today. Right, there might be ones that were hundreds of years old that are still in business, but eventually all those will go defunct as well. So no company lasts forever, and you have to understand what are the circumstances that kill companies. And usually it's another company or another industry that totally wipes out the customer base of the existing company. Now, the author turns conventional wisdom on its head. They debunk the myth that high-octane, built-to-last companies can continue to excel year after year. The book reveals the strategies that corporations must adopt in order to remain competitive over time. So when you are looking at a company, you got to ask yourself, is that corporation employing those principles to stay in business over the long term, if you are a long-term investor? Now, there are many more books that there that we recommend and assure you that they're well worth the read. So look for the recommended book section on investtalk.com if you want to read up and get better knowledge about the market, the economy, etc. Now, what questions do you have today about your money topics? I'm sure you have a lot. It was a very eventful day in the markets. And if you have any money questions, please drop in on us now. We're live 4 to 5 Pacific time. Our number is 888-99-CHART. That's 888-992-4278. You can call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Leave your message and we will answer it on the next show. So let's take this question now from that 24-hour listener line.
Steve, I have a two-point question. My name is Matt. The first question is about using P/E ratios in investment. You know, retained earnings, they don't seem to benefit the common shareholder very much. And why is that so important as an investing tool? And the second part is when a company's reporting earnings and if the company pays a dividend, do they remove the dividend portion out of the earnings before they report P/E ratio? I've always wondered if when they say dividend yield, is that like a, and then P/E earnings, is that like a double dip sort of thing? Are they reporting in two categories or earnings reported separately from the dividend? Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, I'm going to answer the last question first because it's a simple answer. Is no, they don't take out the dividend that is paid out to the shareholder when they're calculating the earnings of the company. That's why we talk about the payout ratio, how much of that earnings are they paying out as a dividend, okay? So no, when they're looking at earnings or P/E ratios, the dividend is not subtracted from that figure. And then he talks about retained earnings. He thinks it says it retains earnings. It doesn't seem like it's beneficial to the shareholder. And that statement is absolutely wrong. In every way, shape, and form, is it wrong? Now, obviously, if you have too much retained earnings, think of Apple, where they have a ton of money on their balance sheet, and it's not being productive, or maybe if they're not employing it productively, then it won't have any benefit to the shareholders. But it always has benefit, some benefit to shareholders. Either it's just a cash cushion, right, to redeploy capital in maybe a down economy or down market. So that's one way you can use the money that is retained, the cash in the balance sheet. Or they take that money and they reinvest in their business. And Apple does that as well, and most companies do that to some extent. And that's what capital spending's about, right? So when they make money and they have this earnings and this cash flow, if it's a good business and it has high return on equity, high return on investment capital, then it makes sense for them to redeploy that in their business and grow the business, right? So yes, absolutely retained earnings benefits shareholders, 100%, meaning they don't have to go out and issue new shares or issue bonds, right? Because think of, there's three ways that companies get money. Three ways. They can issue more shares, right? Whether it's preferred shares, common equity, shares, right? We can go into some details of each, but there's three basic ways. They can borrow money, either through the bond market, from banks, from another institution, individual, whatever, right? They can raise debt that way, or from retained earnings, profits that they don't have to use to pay interest and pay money back, whatever. And they can take that money and they reinvest in their business to grow their business. And that's retained earnings, the money that's left over after paying all their expenses. That's goes straight to the bottom line. That's what grows the book value of a company. Okay. So absolutely 100%, yes, retained earnings does have a very, very positive effect over the long term of a business as long as they are employing that retained earnings in a productive capacity, meaning a good ROI, high return on investment. If it's a company that's burying money, putting money in their business that is burning cash or no longer relevant or whatever, doesn't have good return on investment, yes, then they're not doing it right. But as long as they're employing it correctly, it's great for the shareholder. Now, despite all of the strengths, there are still some areas of the investment universe that ETFs aren't able to journey into. When to use an ETF versus a closed-end fund. I think a lot of people might be chasing some of these closed-end funds. There's some from PIMCO that are pretty interesting, but also pretty risky. And we're going to talk about that. It all has to do with chasing yield in this environment. And we're going to discuss that coming up on Invest Talk. And that's our main talking point today. But I'm sure everybody wants to talk about one thing today, and that is Greece. So we're going to touch on Greece. What type of situation are they in? What's next for this saga? And, you know, now what? Now what with Greece? Okay. So we're going to talk about that. I also want to talk about capital controls. Greece has now employed capital controls. What is the history of capital controls? Positive, negative? We're going to talk about that. And then I also want to discuss legal marijuana stocks. I get this question a lot. I've had at least, I would say, a dozen questions over the last year, so probably one a month, which doesn't sound like a lot, but I think, you know, one particular area of the market, that's kind of a lot. And I think it's also buys into that whole, you know, kind of get rich quick type of idea that people have with the market, and they think that these marijuana related stocks are going to be huge winners when and if marijuana eventually becomes legal at some point in the future, which I'm sure it will, just a matter of how long that is. And the big question is it make sense? What are the risks? And you'll see that the risks far outweigh the benefits for a variety of reasons. So we'll get to that. But ultimately, I want to hear from you. Give us a call, 888-99-CHART. Let's look at the market today. We obviously had a bad Monday. Why did we have a bad Monday? Well, if you are not up on reading the news today, then you missed out on some big news over the weekend. Is Greece is now taking the package that they've negotiated with their creditors to the Greek people and to vote on is that yes or no. And they've instituted capital controls, and there's a whole lot going on in Greece, and there's a lot of worry that that could spread. So that's what pushed the market down broadly about 2% on average, about 2.5% on the NASDAQ, and 2.5% on the Russell small caps, and globally as well. So it was a pretty bloody day on the overall markets. Now, one of our more popular investment programs at KPU Financial is our Balanced Income Program. We create a strategy designed for investors who have a lower risk tolerance but still want some exposure to the potential growth of the stock market. Take a look. That's on investtalk.com. Check in now with your questions about dividend-paying investments or any money matters at 888-99-CHART.
One of the ways we serve our listeners is individual portfolio checkups. Steve meets with a limited number of listeners at KPP offices in Northern and Southern California. And if you're a podcast listener and you don't live in those areas, there are ways you can avail yourself of this service too. Just call 888-99-CHART and find out more about it.
All right, let's go to our talking point today, and that's about when to use an ETF versus a closed-end fund. Now, ETFs are becoming more and more popular by the day, and the money in ETFs has now surpassed $2 trillion. Now, that still is dwarfed by the mutual fund industry, which I think is in the mid-teens in trillions of dollars, but it's growing, and it doesn't seem like it's going to slow down. I mean, I'll say this. I think it will slow down in the next big bear market because people want index, and that certainly is great during bull markets, and people find out it's not so great during bear markets. Anyways, despite all the strengths in the ETF, which there are a lot of strengths, they aren't able to journey into areas of the marketplace that some people want to have exposure to, and their structure and investment mandates don't allow them to do that. So one solution is to fill those gaps is to use closed-end funds, which are more flexible in how the underlying portfolio is managed. Now, closed-end funds are a very close cousin to the ETF, but it is different. It is different to some extent. So we're going to talk about what those differences are, what type of strategies can they employ, and where is it most common, and whether or not you should be using them. All right. Now, have you thought about a portfolio checkup? Having a professional look over your shoulder and review retirement accounts takes about an hour, and it's something Steve does for a limited number of listeners each month. And he'll be in San Diego on July 8th and in San Jose on the 15th. To sign up, just go to investtalk.com.
Thanks again for subscribing to our podcast. This college savings plan allows you to use all the money it's accumulated for college without sharing it with Uncle Sam. Why the 529 for your future grads? That's our talking point for Tuesday's podcast.
8899 chart, 8899924278. Give us a call. Ask your question. We have about 35 minutes left in the show, but it does come quick or go quick. So please call in and ask your question if you do have one. Now let's talk about our talking point and continue talking about it. It's about closed-end funds versus ETFs. And, you know, closed-end funds are a close cousin to the ETFs. And they're a little bit different because they can't create or redeem new shares like an ETF. I don't know if you know this, but just like a closed or an open-ended mutual fund, you know, that prices, you know, one time at the end of each day, the fund family can create and destroy shares as investors' demand for them, you know, increases or decreases. With a closed-end fund, they can't do that. It's a fixed number of shares that are released out into the marketplace. They do some one-time offerings, but those are kind of one-offs and not really much to discuss there. But basically, there's a fixed number of shares that are issued, and the market price can fluctuate to a premium or a discount to the underlying net asset value of that particular fund. And in addition, closed-end funds are typically allowed to employ things like leverage and sophisticated investment strategies to try to enhance their yields. Okay, which typical ETFs, you know, I'm talking about leverage ETFs, but normal ETFs that follow an index, they don't do that. Okay, now, you know, certain ETFs, they usually follow sectors or international exposure, or commodities, etc. Whereas closed-end funds require a deeper understanding of the manager's investment philosophy and portfolio construction techniques. A lot of times they're not simple, they're not straightforward, and managers do have a lot of leeway on how they manage the portfolio. And the fact that they can use leverage and do some unique things means that the risks are a lot higher than a typical ETF in a lot of cases. Not every case, but in a lot of cases. For example, there's one fund which is, it's very interesting. It's called, its symbol is PHK. It's a PIMCO high income fund. And this had a peak back in 2012, and it peaked at about 1450 or so. And it yields like 15% or so, but it's leveraged and has a lot of leverage. And that's how they get that yield. And now today, it's trading at $9.50. So it's gone down over 30, 40%. But all of, and everyone says, well, I got the yield. But you've been more than wiped out in underlying price of that particular issue since late 2012. Yeah, you've gotten some dividends to make up for that. But you're really not going anywhere, and you're paying taxes on a lot of those dividends. So you're not ahead. And there's a few like that. There's RCS, which is another PIMCO leveraged one. There's PDI, which is a PIMCO Dynamic Income Fund, which has 43% leverage. So, you know, and they're usually related. The ones that have leverage, a lot of closed-end funds, they're tied to the fixed income market. They're not great alternatives. They can be part of your portfolio, but you need to understand the differences, the risks involved, and don't get over-reliant on these closed-end funds, because a lot of times they're illiquid and they don't trade nearly as much as ETFs, and therefore they're pretty risky. Now, your questions come first, whether you have a stock, a strategy to discuss, whatever it is, we're here for you at 888-99-CHART.
Paul from Sydney, Australia. This is another podcast. And the question is, does a 200-day moving average apply to ETFs? And do you use a weekly or a daily 200-day moving average? Thanks.
Yes, I would say they do because they give you a good sense. He's talking about the 200-day moving average. They give you a good sense of the long-term trend of the market, and it's usually good institutional support at those levels. And a daily and weekly, yes, both of them, 200-day moving average, 200-week moving average, they both apply. All moving averages have some significance. A lot of it depends on various things. It's not just one fact. It's just one factor, right? A moving average is one factor to consider. And whether it's been touched multiple times, that matters to how significant it is. How long ago it touched that moving average, that's also something to be considered. So yes, they all matter, and something that everybody should understand when they're looking at overall markets, ETFs, individual stocks, whatever it is. Now, you heard of us talk about the stop loss order. Now, why use them and how? That's coming up on Invest Talk 101 in the next half hour, right here on Invest Talk, where you can turn for straight talk about your money.
Part of the Invest Talk experience is visiting our website, investtalk.com. And one of the reasons for a visit is Steve's market commentary. Just go to investtalk.com and scroll down to his market commentary.
Now let's talk a little bit about Greece. Are we going to talk about Greece or are we going to do Invest Talk 101? Which one? Okay, let's talk about Greece. Sorry, I'm talking to our producer. So we all know about Greece, or at least you should know about Greece. If you don't know about what's going on in Greece, you're not paying attention to the markets today. So we all know that the Greek Prime Minister, Alexis Tsipras, has announced a referendum, or basically a vote to the people for or against the new bailout terms coming from their creditors. And he thinks that they won't be thrown out of the Eurozone if they say no to this agreement, because he thinks that the cost would be too enormous. So what he thinks is that he's basically saying the Greek people, vote no, we're going to take this to them and basically use this as a bargaining chip that our people aren't going to agree to this idea, right? And he thinks that they'll find a way to keep them in the euro on better terms, better bailout terms. He says the referendum will give a stronger negotiating position than when talks resume, and the higher the participation and the number of people voting no, the stronger our position will be. So that's what he thinks. Now, what does the S&P think? Well, S&P cut Greece's credit rating to CCC- from CCC. A little late to the game. But let's talk about the situation here. The Eurogroup has decided to let Greece bailout expire tomorrow and has left the country to decide whether to proceed with this new bailout position, new bailout deal. Now, Greek voters will accept the demands of will either accept the demands of creditors or say no. They accept it, well, the negotiations kind of end. Or they could reject the demands, and then Greek leaders would probably return to the table to see if they can compromise again with them, with the threat of leaving the euro area hanging over their heads. Hopefully, they can find a middle ground. That's the hope. Now, the Eurogroup's rejection of Greece's request for reprieve beyond Tuesday considerably complicates the situation. And why is that? Well, if Greece were to agree to the demands of the creditors, after Tuesday, the Eurogroup could only accept the outcome as a basis for a third bailout package. Now, a third bailout package could still allow Greece to avoid default, but the timeline would be very tight. And why is that? Well, the IMF bailout package wasn't set to end until February 20th of 2016. So remember, the bailout package is a joint agreement between the Eurogroup and the IMF. And the Eurogroup's agreement expires tomorrow. But the IMF doesn't expire for, you know, another 6 months or so. So the IMF's role in this new bailout, this is the second bailout, shouldn't really expire on Tuesday when the Eurogroup's does. However, Greece is still likely to miss its June 30th payment to the IMF. And as soon as that happens and it falls into arrears, it's cut off from all financial aid. That's according to their rules, IMF rules. Now, in order for Greece to receive that IMF payment, so that they can pay the 7.2 billion euros that are due, the people would have to vote and accept the demands of the creditors. And then the country would have to repay the 1.5 billion euros. They have a bunch of deadlines coming up in July. If Greece votes against accepting its creditors' demand on July 5th, the government would have to say that it's unwilling to do what the Eurogroup asks. And if the finance minister were still unwilling to budge, then the heads of government would probably have to decide whether they want to preside over the departure of Greece from the euro area, which is likely if the country misses the ECB payment. Or if European leaders are ready to accept that Greece exit, they could either enter into negotiations for a managed departure, which would probably be the best case, or let the country slide out just by letting it default by July 20th. So between now and July 20th, you're going to have a resolution. So we have 3 weeks. It's going to be messy. There are going to be a lot of rumors and, you know, positives coming out, negatives, rumors, positive rumors. It's going to be a wild ride, I think, for the next 3 weeks in the market. And actually, I think for the next 3 or 4 months. Now, we're here live 4 to 5 Pacific time each day, but we can take your call anytime, 8899-CHART. If you're not with us then, call our 24-hour listener line.
Hi, my name is Gary. I listen to your show by podcast. I'm calling from Massachusetts, and I'd like to know your opinion on Bed Bath & Beyond. The symbol would be BBBY. I'd like to know what you think your valuation is going out a year. Thank you very much for your show, and look forward to hearing your answer. Thank you.
All right, he's looking at Bed Bath & Beyond. Most people know what they do. They operate at over 1,000 Bed Bath & Beyond, big box retail stores, and some other stores as well in 50 states. Wow, they're in all 50 states, in D.C., Puerto Rico, and Canada. So pretty much North America. P is about 14. Earnings supposed to go up 4% in 2016 and 6% in 2017. No dividend. Modest amount of debt. Good cash flow, but it is falling. Cash flow is down about 20% from 2014 levels. So that's not good. What else? Return on equity is good, 28%, and that's going up. That's a positive. Their debt level is rising. I don't like that. The chart is making lower highs and lower lows. I would say I'm not a big fan of this. I think it's a little expensive. It retested its highs back in the beginning of 2014 and has failed from there. I would say this was going to go down more, probably much more. I'm going to go with $47. If I can get in the high 40s, then I'd pick it up. But not until then. Now it's turning at 68.77. So I think you have a good amount lower to go. And that is when I would pick it up. The high 40s. But not until then. But a good company to have in your watch list. Now Invest Talk 101. Let's talk about that. Stop loss orders. Now here's a definition of a stop loss order from investopd.com. An order placed with a broker to sell a security when it reaches a certain price. Now, stop-loss order is designed to limit investors' loss on a position in a particular security. Now, although most investors associate a stop-loss order only with a long position, it can also be used for a short position as well, in which case the security would be bought back if it trades above a defined price, right? Because if you're short a stock and it goes up, you're going to lose money. Now, a stop-loss order takes the emotions out of trading decisions and can be easily be especially handy when one is on vacation or cannot watch his or her positions, which that's most people. You know, they're working all the time. They don't have time to watch the market each and every day. Now, but you got to be cautious. Execution is not guaranteed, particularly in a situation where trading in the stock is halted or gaps down well below or above, depending on your long or short, the particular price that you have that stop in at. So understand there, it's not always as simple as it might seem, but they are good tools to use if you are looking to limit your risk in a particular holding. Now that's Invest Talk 101. Do you have more questions about stop loss orders or whether you should use them? Now's a good time to ask. Or you can ask any other money questions. We have about 15 minutes left in the show. 888-99-CHART is our direct line, and I welcome your call on Invest Talk.
A quick reminder, if there's a term that you hear mentioned on the program but you're unclear about what it means or you have a question about it, we want you to ask. It's very likely that you're not the only one with that same question. 888-99-CHART.
Hey, Jen from Denver, Colorado. Here's my question. I'd like to buy some stocks and then write covered calls on them. So what's the best way to identify your ETFs or stocks that don't move around very much so that they don't get called away? So thank you. Bye.
All right. She wants to employ a covered call strategy. And it's not a bad strategy. It's more complex than I think most people give it credit for. But it is one of the simpler strategies, and if you're going to employ options, I would use beta. Beta is a good measure to figure out how volatile a particular ETF or company is. So it's certainly one measure to use. There are some other ones, but that's a good measure. You know, a beta of one, it has the volatility of the overall market. Anything over one means it's more volatile than the S&P. Anything below one means it's less volatile than the S&P. But something you also have to understand is that just because it has a low beta doesn't mean that you are getting a free lunch or anything, you know, you're discovering anything new. You're not. Because if it's a low beta name, whether it's an ETF or an individual stock, the premiums you get for writing those call options are going to be less, and many times significantly less, than the call options that you'll get on more volatile names. So you have to understand that the market's going to price that out and account for that low volatility. So certainly you'll have less risk in your portfolio, but you also get less premium for the calls that you are selling for that covered call strategy. All right? So just be aware of that. So let's go over the Greek crisis for the next 3 weeks. I said, you know, for the next 3 weeks, it's going to be pretty important what goes on. Obviously, tomorrow you have the Greece's euro area back bailout extension will expire. And that's when they owe about $1.5 billion to the IMF. That's what comes due. The next big date will be the 5th. Greek voters are scheduled to decide on the referendum on creditors' proposal for unblocking the next bailout. And that will really decide what happens next. You know, if they decide to stay in, you still have July 8th, they have 26-week treasury bills that they're planning on selling. July 10th, they need to refinance $2 billion in treasury bills that already exist. They need on July 13th, IMF loan payment totaling $450 million is due. Then July 20th, this is really that hard date. Greece needs to repay 3.5 billion euros in bond redemptions held by the ECB. And then in August, they have tons. They have $3.2 billion in bond redemptions, another $3.2 billion in bond redemptions to the ECB. They have interest payments that total about $1 billion. Or billion euros. So it's going to come up fast. It's going to come up quick. And it's going to be very interesting to see if they can find a way to stay in the euro. It's going to be difficult. But I think it certainly could be possible. Now let's take a quick look at the history of capital controls. Okay, you know, the free flow of money across national borders really is the soul of modern, the global economy, right? We're in a globalized world. The idea that money can flow from one market to another, from one currency to another, has really helped the world in many ways. It's created the ability to do business outside our country much easier. And when countries employ capital controls, that flies in the face of everything we know and understand about our global trade, right? Now, capital controls have been used throughout history. And what capital controls are is it stops people from taking money out of banks or limits the amount of money that can be taken out of banks. Currently in Greece right now, I think it's 60 euros per bank account that they can take out per day, which isn't a lot, but you know, people are still doing it. They're trying to get as much money as they can. And 37 countries have restricted the flow of money out of their economies between 1995 and 2010. And you know, the most recent example is Cyprus. 2013, became the first country in the euro area to impose these capital controls during their banking crisis. And even last year, you had Belarus, Ghana, the Ukraine, because of the conflicts with Russia. They also employed capital controls. So this isn't something that is necessarily a shock or anything new. It happens. So after the break, I'm going to talk about what is the history and what does this mean going forward for Greece. Now, I know there are questions you've been saving. I'm financial advisor Justin Klein. We have about 10 minutes left in the show to get your call in. So if you're going to do it now. You can reach me right now at 888-99-CHART, and I'll do my best to answer your question on InvestTalk.
Our podcast distribution is made possible each day by KPP Financial, Steve Peasley, President. And remember, you can get a question to Steve or Justin directly and get an answer back by email. Just go to investtalk.com and click on Contact Steve or Contact Justin.
Let's answer one of your questions. Joe called us from Corona. 888-99-CHART is how you can get your question to us anytime.
Yes, I had a question regarding CDs and how they would appeal to anybody. I'm basically trying to find out what the benefit is of investing into them. Thank you. Bye.
One word, safety. That's it. CDs are safe. They're FDIC insured. Certainly, the yields right now are extremely low, so you're not going to get much reward out of them, but that's the nature of the wacky times we are in of zero interest rate policies. It's just purely safety. You're going to get your principal back. You're going to get your dividend or your yield, and you won't have any risk of days like today, right, where the market went down big. So that's the appeal, is safety. So let's get back to a history of capital controls. I think this is interesting. We all know that Greece implemented their capital controls today. And in recent times, capital controls are pretty common. You know, capital controls really started after in the 1930s during the Great Depression to help economies, help from stop money from fleeing countries. Now, in China, the government has had capital controls for a long time, but they're starting to relax those controls that have anchored the economy for really about 30 years. Now, to discourage foreign money from flooding a national economy or leaving it high and dry, a government can restrict withdrawals from banks, limit foreign exchange transactions, or tax the purchase of stocks and bonds. These are all types of capital controls. And like I said, they were measures that were very uncommon until the 1930s. Now, only in 1971, when Richard Nixon, President Nixon, abandoned the dollars pegged to the gold standard, did major currencies start floating and countries lift these capital controls. Now, a new consensus favoring open capital markets lasted until the Asian financial crisis of the late 1990s, which provided evidence that capital controls could work. Malaysia recovered pretty quickly after imposing these restrictions in September of 1998. However, South Korea recovered also without them. So, could have been because of the capital controls, could have been something else. Now, by 2010, the IMF started to acknowledge that capital controls can forestall a financial crisis. Now, limited controls on capital inflows are also thought to be a good thing because they can prevent currency overvaluation and financial bubbles. You know, think of think of China, where everybody's putting money into China, and obviously we're seeing that bubble crash right now. Limiting how the pace that money can flow into an economy from outside countries will limit the ability for that market to get, overly bullish and overly frothy. So it can work both ways. And in a financial crisis, restrictions on outflows give policymakers some breathing space to address the shortcomings in their economies and ward off any panic selling. Now, usually investors find ways around them, so it's not perfect. That's why capital controls work best on an island. But they do things, through financial innovation, bribery. I think even Bitcoin is getting a boost right now because of that's one way that people are trying to get money out of Greece quickly and efficiently is through Bitcoin. A lot of times they do find ways around it, but it can be beneficial in the short term. That's what's shown, and that is why so many countries have employed that idea and this tactic to try to keep their banking system solvent. It's really the goal, is because they're trying to stop a run in the bank. And when there's market panic, economic panic, what do people do? They try to get their money out of the bank. They try to get it in safe assets so they don't lose anything. And that's what's happening in Greece. And that's probably what's going to happen till the end of time, over and over again. It's never going to stop. It's going to happen again. This isn't the first time. It won't be the last time. Now, we're out of time for today. A reminder before we go, one of our more popular investment programs is our Balanced Income Program. KPP Financial creates a strategy designed for investors who have a lower risk tolerance but still want some exposure to the potential growth of the stock market. Take a look at the details on investtalk.com. I'm financial advisor Justin Klein, and for Steve Peasley and everyone at KPP Financial, thank you for listening. I hope you have a good evening. Let's meet here again tomorrow.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for listeners to understand that not all comments made will apply to them specifically. Nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell securities. Such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. Steve Peasley and Justin Klein are principals of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, which retains all rights.